the middle of the week and plenty on the radio. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
I would absolutely love, I'd love to buy a pair of those rose-tinted glasses you're wearing. You're glorifying and you're talking about your ancestors and people you know. And that's great for you, Patricia. Congratulations that you've never personally been touched by the horror of the Catholic Church and those who, you know, apparently worked and did God's work. There was no God's work done there.
You know, life is so precious and life is so important.
You got a sense of the fragility of it all.
I did, and I remember thinking as a teenager, I'm not going to know what it's like to grow old.
Or another one is as a protection against the fairies, because they might want you to get lost, is if you turn your coat or your jumper or whatever inside out before you go into a field or even before setting out.
And we'll start on the live line in the afternoon. And Katie Cannon was looking at the new maternity hospital and comments made about nuns.
Now we're told the government is pressing ahead with the development of the National Maternity Hospital on the site of St Vincent's Hospital down the road from us here in Dublin 4. This is in the teeth of a very divisive debate during which much has been said about the role of the nuns in all of this. And our next caller now got in touch with us saying that they are appalled. Patricia, you're appalled at the way the nuns are being referred to in this debate.
Yeah, I feel that during the discourse on the National Maternity Hospital, I'd like to strongly object to the way nuns are being referred to. I don't think any other profession would tolerate the disrespect with which they're being referred to. My grand-aunt was a Bon Secours nun. I feel like I have to speak up for her. She was 14 years old when she joined the convent. She lived a life of indentured domestic servitude. She died in penury. I see her as a Magdalene girl. She came from a devout family of 10 children where she had no choice but to join the order. She absolutely sacrificed her life along with many, many others who made our lives ultimately better now by providing free healthcare, free education. And it hurts me to think of her every time the nuns are referred to so disparagingly in the national media.
Yeah, and even the way we say the nuns, I mean, obviously the nuns in question that we're talking about down the road in St. Vincent's are the religious sisters of charity. But
if we spoke about farmers or teachers or comedians or any other profession the way we speak about the nuns, they would be national outcry.
Do you understand, though, you know, why there was such a debate around the role of the nuns in this
Absolutely.
Particular case? Yeah,
absolutely. But I think you cannot, in every profession, there will be bad apples, and you can't tar a complete profession, especially a profession who was so self-sacrificing for the most part, and so idealistic. I think it's just such an injustice to speak about nuns the way we're referring to them in the national media.
I suppose that, well, you know, you talk about your grand-aunt, and, you know, I had an aunt myself who would have been around that same age when they were professed or when they joined an order. You said that you think of her as a Magdalene, but I suppose the difference is it was her choice to join.
Absolutely, she had no choice to join.
She had no choice.
She had absolutely no choice. She was 14 years old when she was noted to be very devout at Mass. Someone suggested from the Bon Secours Order that she would make a good nun. She was taken to the convent where she had never seen a gramophone before. She was waltzed around the room. Next thing she noted, her parents were gone. And that was the... That's how she joined. That's how she found out that she was becoming a nun.
But, okay, and you could say in that scenario that young girl, she was a child still, obviously, at 14, that she was, you know, a victim maybe of an ideology that she, you know, had no hand, act or part in.
And there were countless others like her who I feel were as much victim of the Magdalene system as the unfortunate girls who ended up in the laundries. She had exactly the same life. She worked in a laundry and a kitchen for her. When she was an old nun and I was a child, she came on holidays to visit us. And my parents went to a wedding and couldn't drop her back to the convent. And she got on the bus with no money and was humiliated by the bus driver and made get off the bus and she was in her 80s. Like, I just think to do that to somebody who has worked for free their entire life, I just feel so badly for nuns and other religious who have to listen to the discourse around the National Maternity Hospital.
But when you say that this was, you know, they were the victims of this setup as much as any of the Magdalene girls that were put, you know, placed with them, they did perpetuate it as well, though. They did, you know, they were in charge of these institutions in many cases.
I think there were certain individuals in power, but I think there were so many who had no power within the system.
And, you know, your aunt, and I mean, that picture you paint of an elderly lady in any circumstances, but in a circumstance, as you say, an elderly woman who has taken a vow of poverty, who doesn't have any, you know, who doesn't have any money, no, or any access to money. I mean, that's obviously horrific and should not have happened. I mean, do you know why it happened or what happened in that circumstances?
I think her whole life she had lived in poverty, so it never even occurred to her. She was, I suppose, institutionalised. She never lived a life outside of poverty. And I just think it's such a slap in the face for... There are lots of nuns in their 80s and 90s and 70s around Ireland who feel that, you know, they did something for their community, not for themselves. And here they are now being spoken of so disparagingly. It must be so hurtful. It's hurtful to me as the grandniece of somebody like that. I just can't imagine what it's like for them.
Well, that's Patricia there. And then Breda was in agreement with Patricia.
Not all nuns were bad. And Ireland would have been a very bad place had we had no nuns. Like, if you think who ran our hospitals in the beginning was all nuns. And they were kind, they were generous, and without them, a lot of people would have died before their time. I attended St. Mary's School for Marion for the blind, and I never experienced corporal punishment, never. Yes, we weren't angels. Like, no child is an angel, no matter who's bringing them up, let it be their parents or anything. I can tell you, I got more beatings from my mother than I did from the nuns, and for silly things. You didn't wash the clothes properly. If the cat knocked down the sugar bowl and the cup broke when they weren't there. Simple, silly things like that to me. And I'm going to tell you now about your Magdalene Laundries. Who sent their daughters to these places but their parents? Their parents got them shifted out in the night so that the neighbours wouldn't know. What will the neighbours say is what your mammy or my mammy would say if I went in and said I was pregnant. I'd be afraid to tell her I was pregnant. But anyway, parents were the downfall of their daughters, not the nuns. Now, how would the nuns cope with maybe 10 girls coming in the 1 week expecting a baby, the baby that wasn't wanted by their grandparents?
But Breda, when you hear the accounts, and the, you know, we've heard many of them now over the years, because finally a lot of those women, you know, a lot of them are elderly women now, are able to speak out and describe their experiences in these institutions. Mm-hmm. They weren't happy experiences, Breda, by any manner or means.
No,
you couldn't
happy.
Stand over
but
what happened to those girls.
Put them there. The nuns but didn't once ask they were, you to bring your
but,
daughter.
But once they were there, how they were treated while they were there, surely that has to count for something.
Yeah. Maybe I'd admit, I don't know. I don't think anyone would be cruel to a baby. And I know it was terrible to see how the babies, when they died, had nowhere to bury them. But could the parents not take the child home and bury it when it died? They didn't get the chance. I mean, to me, parents were wrong. They were very, very wrong. Yes, maybe some nuns were wrong, but my experience of the nuns, we got a powerful education. Had I stayed at home, I wouldn't be able to do my own housework now. I wouldn't have been able to mind my 11 children.
Then Lisa called in.
I'm just appalled at listening to anyone trying to defend the indefensible and to minimise the pain and suffering of thousands upon thousands of women, children and men at the hands of nuns and the church. I mean, that cannot be. We can't simply say, oh, this one was nice and that one was nice. In my mind's eye, if a nun, even the one who was decent, shall we say, if she was there and she witnessed the apparent cruelty, well, then she's complicit in the whole thing because she watched it and did nothing.
But did they have power, though, those nuns, Lisa?
Of course they had. They did the power to open them out. And I do understand that they were part of an order and it was, you know, a lot of the nuns were young going in themselves. And I understand that. I do, Katie, to a degree. But, there's, you know, one of the ladies was saying they're older now. Well, you know, if they're older now, let's not just start defending them when it comes to money, because the monetary gain and all of this for the church is, you know, this is always the time when you'll find people speaking up and defending them. You know, the older ones, why are they not coming out and saying, sorry, I was there to witness your baby being pulled from your arms and being sold to the highest bidder. Sorry that you were left in labour for 36 hours with no pain relief. Sorry that your child was put into a defect ward because it had a hair lip. Stuff like that. I mean, they're older now, so have the honesty to come forward and say sorry. Don't just come on out talking now because there's money involved. And that's what sickens me, Katie.
Patricia, there'd be a lot of people will feel the way Lisa feels.
I think it's really due to what you've been exposed to during your life. I mean, the nuns and priests I knew were the most selfless, giving people. Most of all my ancestors were either preachers or teachers, and the ones who went abroad and worked as missionaries, they devoted their whole lives to what they felt was an ideal. And the ones I knew who taught me in school, the ones I knew who worked on shoestring budgets in hospitals, they were just remarkable individuals. Were there bad individuals amongst a cohort of people? Absolutely, as there is in any profession.
But no, really, you don't get that in every profession. Hang on, sorry, Patricia. I would absolutely love, I'd love to buy a pair of those rose-tinted glasses you're wearing. I'd love to wear them. I think for you to, you know, you're glorifying right across the board there, and you're talking about your ancestors and people you know. And that's great for you, Patricia. Congratulations that you've never personally been touched by the horror of the Catholic Church and those who, you know, apparently worked and did God's work. There was no God's work done there to those women, to those children in institutions, in child prisons. Let's face facts. Reformatories. What does that word mean? No child went into any reformatory and was reformed. Reformed for what? Like, how can you defend that? How? My father was in one of those kips. He was in Offaly. I won't name the place, Katie, just in case. But he was incarcerated in there. And that's what it was. He was looked after by Christian brothers. And there were nuns there too. And let me tell you now, he wasn't reformed. And let me tell you, I'm 51 years of age. And me, I personally have felt the ripple effect of that right throughout my life. So don't rose-tint glass this, Patricia, because I know what I'm talking about. And the apparent cruelty was disgusting. It was appalling what was done to those children. It's indefensible.
That's Lisa on the Live Line with Katie Hannan. And on the Ryan Tubridy Show, on a blue sky, fine weather morning, Ryan hit the road to Galway, stopping by in Moat and County Meath too.
It is a beautiful morning, I have to say, here in the west of Ireland. One of my favourite places to be in the whole wide world. And why wouldn't it be? We had a very busy day from the moment we hit the road yesterday to get across the country. And we met so many people along the way. It just felt very, very liberating to be out and about, because it's been a while since we could do this in any meaningful way. So we are delighted to be here. We stopped. I'll give you a little kind of rundown of where we went, because you get a sense of what we do when we hit the road. But we stopped in Moat. There's a little restaurant in Moat called the Tour Ard restaurant. It's run by Shirley Rooney. And she and her staff run a great Irish dinner in the middle of the day. You know that delicious, the curry, chicken curry with the half and half? Oh, magnificent. And bottles on each table of my Waddy Orange. Yes. And jugs of iced water come to the table. And that's not just like Johnny Chacho. Like everyone gets that, you know, everyone gets a lash of the my Waddy. And it's fair and so, but even then, going around to all the tables and chatting to everyone and saying hello and that sense of we're back and people from all that lovely woman Miss Cafola who was well she was hit me up for a couple of tickets for the Late Late Show too, but why wouldn't she? And she was great. She was in the corner of the restaurant with her, well, with her gang. And then I met school people, school boys and girls, and there was the babies, of course, always babies, Helena and Fionn. And I was able to, this nice thing about, you can leave the radio, but you can curate it all on Instagram, which I find very handy. So you can put up the pictures and the footage. You can watch us, and on our Twitter and on our Facebook, I should say. It's all there to watch and see all these faces of the people. Anyway, Shirley, who runs the place brilliantly, said, I don't suppose you have a minute to go across the road to the school, the community school. I said, well, we'll make some minutes, of course. Yeah, let's go. And across we went to the Moat Community College. Because I had met some of the students there when they had come in with a junk couture item on the Late Late Show not so long ago. And they said, come on into the school. So Mr. Lowry met us at the gate, brilliant principal, and he brought us around some of the classrooms, and we met first years, we met transition year students, we met, I asked could I go into the history class just to make sure that they all knew how brilliant they were and how never bored they'll be. Religion class, where they were about to do meditation. I'm sure I wrecked that buzz. But I just thought, God, man, religion class when I was a kid was not very interesting. And now it's much more broad in scope. And as I say, they're about to do meditation. Great teachers. But also then with the art room, which was magnificent. No wonder they did so well in Junk Couture, because Miss Kyo's art room was full of, you know, puppets and bags of equipment and bits of discarded, what we would call rubbish, what they call art, because it'll become next year's project. Anyway, it's lovely. Hit the road again. Out of Moat and down to Galway. And one of the places we really wanted to visit was the Barbaro Children's Arts Festival, our friends there, because they had been among the recipients of the Toy Show Fund appeal. And I was just curious to see how some of the money is spent, you know, literally, because you donated it. I asked you to do. And I just wanted to see where's it all going. And I'm glad to be able to report in this small, in this just this one of the, as I was saying to Saoirse Ruan and her folks the other night, because of Saoirse, this fund started. And she's from Kiltulla, which is not far from us here in Galway, thinking of her this morning. And she, because of the fund, it has now affected 1 million Irish people.
And there'll be more from Ryan in Galway later in the programme. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Irish place names and their origins. Cathy Scuffle, historian in residence with the Dublin City Council, and linguist and folklorist Robbie Sinnott.
So Robbie, we were talking the last time, as I said there, about nature, but we want to talk a little bit about man-made structures now and the role that they play in the names of the villages and towns.
Yeah, I suppose Bally would be probably the most common that people would know about, which is actually quite recent in terms of it actually just came around the time the Norman invasion, although it's definitely an Irish word, possibly coming from Billa, which means an oak, the centre of a place. But it's definitely a homestead. But it was only started to be used, so you can tell any place that starts with the name Bally, it wasn't named before the 12th century. So it just coincided with the time that the Normans were coming to town, so to speak. So we've got the likes of Ballymoney in Antrim, Ballybay in Monaghan, Ballybunion, as everybody goes on holidays down in Munster, and Kerry Ballygar in Galway, and Ballymore, a very common one. Ballygar being a short Bally, and Ballymore being a large one.
Yeah, and generally speaking, and is that linked to the Irish for town?
Oh, it is. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it is. Yeah, the Irish for town comes from that. Originally comes from Billa, then comes to Bally, meaning a homestead, and then becomes a town. A main centre of residence and stuff, especially as the monasteries started to build up around these residences.
And then we have a dune.
Oh yeah, dune is oh yeah, there's a fair few actually. There's a lovely one with dune because you've got Listdune Varna, which combines a few things. The fort of the gap, Listdune Varna, which is it's got everything going on there in County Clare.
So the fairies and the forts.
Oh, yeah, the fairies. Yeah, that's right. You see, the Lys is Lysandrath is a fairy, and the fourth. But Dun also gives us Dundalk, Dungiven in Derry, and Dungarvan in Waterford, and Dunbeg. We all know about Trump Tower, but I heard it in an ad called Tramp Tower, because they were trying to overdo the poshness of the accent. It had a reverse effect. And so, we have the rats, loads of rats. Rat Newer in Wexford, which is the rat of the U, and we have, we said Dungarvan, but there's Liscannor and Listool, which is northern Liss. And I suppose Lissy Casey's a lovely one because it's Ichasi, or Casey's Fort, Fairy Fort, which is also down in Clare. So they've got lots of Lisses on their Lisnaski and Fermanagh and Lisburn, which is possibly a mixture of the burn, a Scottish word meaning burn for a sort of a waterway, plus Fairy Fort Liss. So it's combining the two, because I think the Irish is Lisna Gadoch for Lisburn in South County Antrim.
And don't mess
Kill,
with the...
We all have Kill as well.
Don't mess with the Fairy Fort. Isn't that the best advice?
Yes, absolutely. You don't know what happens. It's still very redolent.
You can dismiss it as bunkum, but you just wouldn't take a chance, you know?
No, absolutely never. No, just like, and as people like, people talk about this fake Irishism and stuff about leprechauns, but up until very recently, people believed in that. There was all their own local words, for instance, in South Leinster, Lurican, I heard Moncon McGann catalogued all the various different names for leprechauns throughout the country. But there are many people still believe in this and are able to tell you where not to cross and where to cross and where's the best thing. And, you know, I'm not going to gainsay them anyway.
I don't think any of us should. We were just talking at the weekend, actually, a few of us, about that story that you hear in Irish houses from time to time about the field. When you go into the field in the dark, a particular field, you can't find the gap to get out, Robbie. Have you come across that one?
Well, you can. You see, there's two. That's linked to a lot of things. That's actually linked to Will of the Wisp, which is also the idea that a light can be seen and that you follow the light and you get lost. Or another one is as a protection against the fairies, because they might want you to get lost, is if you turn your coat or your jumper or whatever inside out before you go into a field, or even before setting out at night, if you're coming home from a music session or whatever, you know, that is one way to make sure that you're going to be all right. Also, if you carry some iron of any type, that generally does the trick as well, or even some thimbles or something like that.
A few thimbles, they jumper, like the jumper on inside out.
Yeah. It does work, I hear.
And Claire asked Cathy about the Huguenots.
Now, Cathy, I want to talk to you about the Huguenots, because 100,000 Huguenots came from Ireland back in the 1600s, but they influenced a lot of our place names and indeed our surnames as well.
That's absolutely true, Claire. And we've great examples in Dublin. And of course, we've great examples in Dublin of how Dubliners don't speak French very well. So the Huguenots in the main were French speaking people when they arrived. So they leave, everybody who comes to Ireland leaves something of themselves behind. And the Huguenots were no different. So in Dublin, we have that wonderful lane, Marrowbone Lane.
Yes.
And that conjures up all sorts of images of butcheries and, meat production and whatever. But it's absolutely nothing to do with that and everything to do with the Huguenots. So Marrowbone Lane should be Marie Le Bon Lane. And Marie Le Bon in Dublinese became Marrowbone, and it's still Marrowbone today.
Isn't that fascinating?
That's one really good example we have.
We just took it. We said we can't be bothered saying that French, it's a bit difficult, and we're just going to call it Marrowbone Lane, and that'll do you, cute Mr. Huguenot.
And one thing I have to give Dublin City Council their due, they have it correct, Oscailge. It's Lana Wirawa, Oscailge. But in the English, it's Marrowbone Lane underneath. So it's one of those wonderful curiosities we have in Dublin. And there's a couple of others very close by, if I can just briefly say.
Go ahead.
There's
a
lovely laneway linking, it sort of links Weaver Square. The Huguenots in the main in Dublin were weavers, so Weaver Square we get from them. And then there's a laneway that links them into the Tenters, which again, I'll just touch on in a second. But the laneway in question is Cow Parlour. And it has nothing to do with parlours or cows, but everything to do with that French again, which is the coup perlée or the hem cutters, a trade within the weaving. And coup perlée became cow parlour, and we still have cow parlour today.
That is fascinating.
And it links to the area called the Tenters, which is the area celebrating, actually the houses there are celebrating 100 years, one of the centenaries we have. First houses built in the Free State are in the Tenters, but the tenters area was where the aforementioned weavers stretched out their cloth to dry after they had bleached it or washed it. So just in a very short part of Dublin, we have an amazing amount of history, all linking back to one group who came to Ireland.
I do love that we took the French and sort of decided you could just say whatever we liked that sounded remotely like it. I mean, Cow Parlour from Coup d'Orlay is fabulous.
That's where we get tenter hooks, being on tenter hooks from the hooks where they hung out the weavers.
Exactly, and probably hung out a few other people as well, Robbie, but that's a talk for another day.
Cathy Scuffle and Robbie Sinnott from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, a conversation about faith, hope and vocation. The very Reverend Linda Pilo was Ryan Tuberty's guest in Galway.
I was having a cup of coffee in Dublin about 2 months ago. And a very nice gentleman was in front of me and we had a small chat. And then afterwards, as he was leaving, he said, come and see us in Galway at the church, at St. Nicholas Church. And I said, you know what, I will. So there I was yesterday with the guys. We went to Charlie Byrne's bookshop and we were wandering around. And you popped in and we got talking because you were wearing your collar. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about who you were and what was happening. And you said, you're up in St. Nicholas Collegiate Church. And I said, we're going there. You said, well, do you want me to bring you? And we said, yes, please. And you gave us the tour. I got to play the bells. We'll get into all of that in a second. But by way of introduction, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What part of the country are you from?
So I am from the centre of the universe in Gieshill.
Yes.
County Offaly is where I grew up. But I have left there a very long time ago.
Yes.
So born and bred, Midlands girl. And I moved to Dublin to be in college, served in Dublin for curacies, mm-hmm. then moved to the Midlands back to Offaly in Kildare for 17 years. And 4 years ago, arrived to Galway.
All right, we're going to go right back to the beginning. Because when you were very little, what did you want to be when you grew up?
What did I want to be? Anything but a priest.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I wanted to teach and I wanted to nurse. And like every little girl, there was all sorts of things I wanted to do. But I had a huge sense of vocation from a very young...
How young?
The time I was... I would... probably place it about 13 or 14.
Right, that is young. What do you do with that when you're so... Because it's such a tricky age anyway. Mm-hmm. And a vocation is such an enormous, profound, theologically challenging, existentially perhaps, philosophically. What do you do with all of that?
You fight it.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You fight it. It was overwhelming. And I told you yesterday, my nickname was Mouse. I was incredibly shy. If you said hello to me, I would blush. Mm. So how could I possibly be in a pulpit? How could I possibly lead services? How could I possibly be with people? And I fought it for a couple of years. And yet I discerned. There's that great word, mulling and discernment in vocation. And I think it's like any vocation. But I remember quite specifically one night saying, OK, God, we'll give it a go. We'll discern further. I'll, you know, speak to people. I'll embrace it. And we'll see, thinking that nothing would come of it. And I felt the most overwhelming peace and joy. And I never looked back. Every door, to some extent, was opened. I was incredibly young. And every time somebody thought, oh, she's too young, she won't get there, she needs to give it time. Every door opened for me. And the more and more I went through those doors towards ordination, the more happier I became, the more at peace. It was overwhelming.
Amazing.
And Ryan asked Reverend Linda about that sense of vocation.
There's no big shout. There's no transfiguration, almost like what Jesus faced on the Mount. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was just a slow, steady feeling within me. And it was a constant pull towards doing this. Even though it was not my comfortable place by any manner of means. But as I said, when I embraced it, I never looked back in terms of the peace, the joy, the motivation. It was overwhelming.
Where did the mouse go?
The mouse eventually disappeared. The mouse got to theological college. And
And I think part of embracing that, the mouse disappeared. Now, there's still, the mouse would appear every now and then. And I probably am an introvert. Not that you would, others would say that.
Certainly not after yesterday. I wouldn't have thought so. Because you're very outgoing, obviously. And you're very enthusiastic. You're very interested in not just your own job, but in the world. So, again, you can still be introverted and be all of those things. But to be out there and communicative like you are, that doesn't strike me as being mouse-like.
No. And I think I think that confidence over time as well.
That's it, isn't it?
Belief. And I honestly believe that my vocation, the more I became involved with people, involved with the church, and I was going through a period as a teenager, as every teenager does, it's a transitional phase as well. And you're finding yourself. And this wouldn't be cool. This would not be normal to be a priest when you're a teenager, to be ordained. But I love people. I'm interested in people. I care about people. So I suppose that's where a lot of that interest, you know, comes as well.
What was your Leaving Cert situation? Because you didn't, it wasn't conventional. Why not?
Because as a teenager, I had several health problems, which complicated life hugely for me. I was at one point my immune system was compromised and my energy levels were very low, so I had to leave school. I wasn't able for school physically, and I decided, because I had my vocation, because I'd made up my mind I wanted to be ordained, I had to matriculate for Trinity. So I did my Leaving Cert through a correspondence course. So I was self-taught my Leaving Cert.
You taught yourself. I mean, sorry, I know you said self-taught should be explanatory, but I just find that extraordinary because it's such a difficult thing to do, I would have thought.
So I suppose I was dedicated, I was driven, I was motivated. And it was it was the only way I was going to get to Trinity to study for ordination. So, so that was not normal. I had done some of the course in fifth year, but then I became ill again.
Okay. Was that difficult? I got the sense your illness was pretty tough going, was it?
It was. Again, it was. There were moments when I just really wasn't sure what the future would hold.
Yes.
But at the same time, it probably equipped me in more ways than I will ever realise. And I live life in a certain way now because of that time.
Really? Mm-hmm. Okay, because it's almost I want to, you know, getting a second chance at life almost. Is it like
I think
that?
So. Because of where I was at and because of my energy levels and because of my health, I really felt that, you know, life is so precious and life is so important.
You got a sense of the fragility of it all.
I did. And I remember thinking as a teenager, I'm not going to know what it's like to grow old.
Right. Well, that's pretty.
Yeah. So that was one of the thoughts that lay with me. Now, obviously, I am. And my children would say I'm old now.
Well,
anyway,
of course.
We're
all old to our children, as you know, Linda. But a lot of people would have been turned off religion with an experience like that, as opposed to turned on to it. But you definitely went the other way.
Yes, absolutely. Very turned into, you know, tuned into God. Yeah. I never felt forsaken. I never felt lost. I just felt God's presence with me the whole way along.
Were you driven by love of God and religion, or was there a certain amount of self desire to achieve, ambition, if you like? Personal ambition is what I'm trying to say.
I think there was a sprinkling of everything.
Really,
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a sprinkling of everything there. But the determination really came from the peace I felt. And for those who have a vocation in anything, I mean, I don't think it's just to ordination. That peace and that power and that draw and that drive to what you're being called to do. And I've never doubted the vocation 25 years on.
And the Reverend Linda spoke about being ordained at a very young age.
I was too young to be ordained initially when we finished, because you have to be 23.
Right.
So I went off to do some time in the States. I did an internship in the States in a parish in Pennsylvania.
Amazing.
And I came back and was ordained. So normally when I was graduating, we did our finals in
May, and then we were all ordained in June, but I didn't turn 23 to July, so I had to wait.
And you got there.
And I got there, okay, in the end, yeah.
You tipped along, and we don't need to get into all of that because I do want to spend some time with talking to you about Galway, which is where we are, and hence the Charlie Burns bookshop. And you brought me to the church. You brought us, myself and Jack and Siobhan, to the beautiful St. Nicholas's. And it was Alistair, is that the
yeah,
the
Alistair is
man?
My colleague.
I'm sorry, I missed him, by the way, yesterday.
Yes, but he is too.
He was very charming, very, very pleasant person. But you became rector here in 2018.
Correct.
And it is a beautiful church. I knew very little about it. I kind of said to you yesterday, Christopher Columbus, that's pretty much it. Why don't you give us the kind of the fun history of the church as much as you can tell.
How long do we have?
Oh, it's a bit like that, isn't it?
It's wonderful.
Just off Shop Street, by the way. If people are passing by, it's just to the right as you're before Easton's or wherever, and it's there waiting for you. Sorry, go ahead.
There's so many nuggets. When we had initially set up our tourism trail, so to speak, there were 25 nuggets or points of interest for people, but there's so many more. But I think what people will, I think I showed you the Smug Angel first and foremost.
So
Cromwell's forces went in and they literally just took away, they didn't want icons, so everything was damaged in there. Their horses were stabled in there and so much of the church was damaged. Yeah. And that's the only angel that wasn't damaged, or whether he was hidden, but his face looks incredibly smug, so we call him the Smug Angel.
Why wouldn't he be? I mean, his wings are intact. I mean, you showed me another angel that wasn't so lucky.
Not so lucky.
Clipped wings, the Irish angel.
Precisely. And somebody else asked, like, why are the side windows, why are they not stained glass? It's because, again, they were destroyed in Cromwellian times.
I was asking about that. They're kind of mullioned or whatever the word is, but they don't have the stained glass.
Yes.
Cromwell, he wasn't one for great design or... any flourishes.
We can attest to that.
Sure can. God, he really... And putting the horses to stable in the church was, I presume, trying to insult the religion, insult the place.
Yes.
Which makes it even more impressive that it survived.
It survived 700 years.
What about that column, the apprentice?
Yes, yeah. I love that. The apprentice column.
So, you're fired.
Exactly. So every apprentice had to, in order to become the master craftsman, had to build their own column. And anyone coming into the church will see that that particular one is different. Mm-hmm. And that was our apprentice column. So I think it's fantastic. But
it's beautiful.
I'm sure there's stories behind those as well.
Gertie?
Oh, Gertie.
Yeah, tell us about Gertie.
So Gertie is our poor organ, which is very much on her last legs. We call her Gertie and she misbehaves just when we have important services coming up
at
the last minute.
She hits the bomb note, does she?
She suddenly, she does what we call ciphering, but she does. And we are... We're hoping to, our plans are to get a brand new organ, but that's going to take forever and ever and ever. Yeah. And in the meantime, we're really praying. Gertie has resurrected several times. She really is in an example of Christ in the Christian tradition, because every time we think Gertie has died, she resurrects.
Okay.
But not without a lot of help and work.
Your dream is to do something special with this gorgeous church. So what's the? Let's go with the ultimate fantasy, and we'll work our way back to the realities.
Are we going there?
Come on.
Okay.
Let's
so,
do it.
So my dream, ultimately, we've just had a conservation management plan completed last year, and you can imagine a church that's 700 years old, 700 years of history. No matter what you do in it, it's going to cost a lot of money, and we need to do a lot. My dream is to.
How much? Come on, the vulgar question. Let's pray to Jesus and see what he has to say.
Okay, so I'm going to say probably 5 to 10 million.
All right.
Is the dream. But that dream, I believe, will become a reality.
I see, I believe you too.
Yes.
I was in St. Patrick's Cathedral with the lovely people there, and they had dreams.
Yes.
And they've come true. I was up in the belfry and the church in the rafters and everything like that, and saw them. It's meticulous and it's heartbreaking, but it's also worth every bit of it.
Absolutely. And it's iconic. I mean, St. Nicholas is an iconic building in Galway.
Yeah.
And there's so much history. It welcomes people in. It's really the people's church.
The Very Reverend Linda Pilo from the Ryan Tiberty Show. And on Today with Clare Byrne, Tánaiste Leo Varadkar.
I'm joined now by An Tánaiste Leo Varadkar, Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment, Fine Gael leader and TD for Dublin West. Good morning, Tánaiste, and welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
You said last night, you were speaking at an event, that in taking unilateral action on the protocol, Britain is breeding mistrust in EU capitals, and you compared what they proposed to do to Russia's breach of international law in Ukraine. Is this the worst that relations have been between Britain and Ireland, in your view?
Oh, well, just to be clear, I don't think it's anything on the level of what's happening in Ukraine. But there is a perversity, I think, in, you know, a British government that is showing real leadership in relation to Ukraine and has been one of the leading countries in helping Ukraine to fight back against what's happening in Russia. At the same time, expressing a willingness to breach international law and to breach a treaty. And, you know, that does cause, I think, puzzlement in European capitals, including here in Dublin, and does cause concern. You know, we negotiated a withdrawal agreement with the British government, including a protocol. They're now proposing to disapply parts of that unilaterally. And that does create an atmosphere of distrust. If we agree anything with them, how will we know that they will honour that agreement? And if we make any concessions, how will we know that we'll get some concessions back in return? And that's usually how negotiation works. It requires a bit of give and take. But it seems that when it comes to this British government anyway, it's all take, and then they try and take some more. And that's not a good basis, unfortunately, for negotiations to succeed or for a good relationship into the future.
And we're relying on EU solidarity here. Like we're relying on the European Union choosing us and a trade war over the other solution, which is to hive off Great Britain and Ireland and ask Ireland to do the checks into mainland Europe. Do you ever imagine or envisage that that could happen, or are you concerned about it?
I don't think that will happen. The European Union works on the basis of solidarity, works on the basis of the rule of law, and works on the basis that when we agree to do things as 27 states, we stick to that. So, you know, I don't think that the European Union would ever try to pressure us to, you know, in some way bear the consequences of the bad behaviour of a British government or a breach of an agreement by a British government, not because necessarily that that's out of, you know, love for Ireland as such, but that itself would undermine the European Union. You know, there are other countries around the European Union as well that might like to pick off bits of the European Union and not have them treated as being part of the core anymore. So, you know, that kind of thing would set off alarm bells.
But you know, when you think
in other countries as well,
when you think about goods moving from Great Britain into Northern Ireland, and the plan is, or the call is certainly from some people, that there would be a green lane. So if the products are not going beyond Northern Ireland, that there would be free movement. I mean, that's a real backdoor into the EU, isn't it? And would we be expected to police the Brazilian beef or the chicken that might be coming from Thailand through that system?
Well, I do think that a trusted trader system is a possibility. There are risks in it, as you say. On the upside, it would allow more products to enter Northern Ireland from Britain without any checks, and I think that would help resolve some of the objections from the unionist community. But there is a risk, of course, of products going south, and that's something we'd have to bear in mind.
And we'd have to check that at the border.
We wouldn't. You know, we would only agree to a trusted trader system if it didn't involve any checks at the border. You know, so that would be obviously a red line. The whole point of the protocol is to make sure that there aren't any checks on the border. So
there's a lot of trust involved there, though, isn't there?
Well, I think there's another issue involved there as well. And, you know, you mentioned there, for example, the possibility that in future Britain might do a trade deal that brings chlorinated chicken in from Thailand or hormone treated beef in from America or who knows what from Brazil or other parts of the world. I'd ask the question, is this something that the Ulster Farmers Union actually wants? Is this something that the DUP, for example, actually wants? And, you know, could this be another repeat of the Brexit moment where people in Northern Ireland who supported Brexit maybe didn't fully understand what the consequences were? Mm-hmm. You know, I would have thought that if it is the case that those kind of products are brought into Northern Ireland by a trusted trader system, never mind them going south, would Ulster farmers not have a difficulty with that? Might Ulster consumers have a difficulty with that?
There's that issue, but also the third country being offered that deal might see a backdoor into the European Union.
Yeah, well, that's why it would have to be very clear that that would not be the case.
Well, that's just an excerpt from Claire Byrne's interview with Taoiseach Leo Varadkar in the morning. Then later on the News at 1, Brian Dobson spoke to UK Ambassador to Ireland, Paul Johnston.
The British Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, has said her government can't delay in bringing forward legislation to scrap elements of the Northern Ireland Brexit Protocol. That's the deal between Britain and the EU to maintain an open border on the island of Ireland. Ms Truss is promising legislation within weeks, but Britain's threat to unilaterally ditch the protocol has been strongly criticised here and in Brussels. We can talk now to the British Ambassador to Ireland, Paul Johnston. A very good afternoon to you and welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Brian. Good afternoon to you.
Can I remind you and our listeners of some of the reaction here to this announcement yesterday by Liz Truss? The Taoiseach, British actions are damaging to trust and will only make it more challenging to find solutions to concerns about the protocol. The Taoiseach, we have difficulty knowing whether we can trust the British government. Mary Lou MacDonald, the UK's actions are akin to a rogue state. Why is your government once again issuing threats to try to get its way over Brexit?
Brian, let's take perhaps a step or two back and say that we, the British government and the Irish government, are absolutely in agreement on the importance of, obviously, peace and stability in Northern Ireland, full respect for the Good Friday Agreement, and as part of that, therefore, we're both absolutely in agreement that it's really important to get the Northern Ireland Executive up and running. And one of the impediments, probably the main impediment to that, is the fact that the unionist parties who've been elected campaigned on a platform of seeking significant changes to the Northern Ireland Protocol. And the British government also sees significant political and practical problems with the Northern Ireland Protocol. We've been discussing this for over a year with the European Commission. They came forward last October with some proposals, but those proposals only offered a reduction from their original goal of the full implementation of the protocol, which no one now thinks is viable or proportionate. And therefore, the difference between us is about what is the right approach to creating a more proportionate, better balanced, more flexible design, and also how we get there.
But let's take a step further back. The withdrawal treaty and the protocol, which is part of that, was the oven-ready deal. We all remember Boris Johnson saying that it was going to get Brexit done. It was pushed through ahead of the British election. And it does have a mechanism for dealing with these problems, the Joint Committee. And yet, as I say, Britain is again issuing threats to try to have its way.
Britain has also issued an invitation. The Foreign Secretary has said she would welcome an early meeting of the Joint Committee in order to address this. Because I want to be clear that our strong preference is for making agreed changes as part of a negotiated solution with the European Union. The problem we face is the protocol is imposing very significant costs and complexity.
Yeah,
on people
but we'll come to that in a moment. But you're saying if you can't, sorry to cut across you, but you're saying if you can't get agreed changes by sitting down and talking to Brussels, you're going to go ahead anyway.
What we're saying is that the overriding importance is to preserve peace and stability in Northern Ireland. One of the things that that requires is a Northern Irish executive be up and running. It's really important, the overall balance of the Good Friday Agreement, that there's not just a strong North-South dimension, but also that there's that connectivity between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And the way the protocol is operating is putting that under considerable political and practical strain, and that's why we see an urgent need to address this. Now, we think the two things can run in parallel. The Prime Minister has been very clear that the executive should be up and running without preconditions. We absolutely agree with the Irish government on that. And we think we can have two processes in parallel, the Northern Ireland executive being established and delivering to the people of Northern Ireland what they asked for in the election, action on cost of living and health, and in parallel discussions with the European Union to seek to resolve the problem of the protocol.
But it's also the case.
We bump up against this position where the Commission is saying we can't contemplate reopening the protocol. Our view is the changes we need will require.
Because you sat down and signed the deal, you sat down and signed the deal when you agreed to the protocol. The deal was done, and now you want to reopen that agreement, that international treaty. And if you don't get your way, you're prepared to break international law by disavowing elements of the protocol.
But the treaty itself, the protocol itself, has an explicit provision which allows for all of it or part of it to be superseded. And what we've seen in the period since the withdrawal agreement and the protocol as part of that was agreed, we've seen obviously the COVID pandemic, We've seen the cost of living crisis, which has arisen from a number of factors. We've seen the Ukraine situation threatening European economies. So we have a variety of factors now, including the way the protocol is being implemented, which means we feel that we need to reopen it and we need to achieve a better balance and more flexibility,
which
would not be possible within the parameters of the current protocol.
Does that mean, Ambassador, then, that Britain reserves the right to break any international treaty it signs if circumstances change?
Britain takes the view that this agreement, which was agreed back in 2019, in the way it is working out in practice and in the situation that we are in today, is no longer delivering on its fundamental objective, which is to support the Good Friday Agreement. That's why we want to seek agreed changes to it.
But you see, the parties, a majority of parties in Northern Ireland don't share that view. At least two-thirds of the newly elected members of the Assembly support the protocol. We also know that Northern Ireland Business says the protocol is working. It's giving businesses their access to the EU market. It's increasing north-south trade. They see it as a win-win.
So I think it's 53 out of 90 members of the Assembly, so just short of 60% rather than two-thirds. But you're right, there's a majority who are in favour of not the protocol as it stands, because I think, as I said earlier, everyone agrees that the original, if you like, full-bodied implementation of the protocol is not going to deliver the flexibility and the connectivity that we need. But there is a significant grouping, about 40% of the MLAs, who want significant change to the protocol. And the fact of the matter is, unless we're able to deliver broader consent for the protocol in Northern Ireland politics, we're not taking, much to our regret, going to get the executive up and running. So we do need to take action.
Have we today, Ambassador, got an insight into British government thinking on all of this with these reported comments by Liz Truss that the only people in Ireland concerned with a no-deal Brexit, she was speaking some time ago, were, and I quote, farmers with a few turnips on the back of their truck. Is that the British government's view?
It's absolutely not the British government's view. For one thing, we avoided a no-deal Brexit. And that was really important. We want to make everything we can out of the trade and cooperation agreement. We have full respect for the importance, as Liz Truss said in the House of Commons yesterday, and as the Prime Minister said in his Belfast Telegraph article, for the importance of the EU single market, Ireland's place within it, Northern Ireland's access to it, which is all extremely important. And you know what matters for us is finding a solution which works to reinforce relationships across the island.
Yeah, but these were the comments of your own. These were the comments of your own foreign secretary. So presumably she speaks with the authority of that office, dismissing concerns as farmers with turnips on the back of their trucks.
I think if you want to understand the government's position and the foreign secretary's position, the things to read in recent days are the Prime Minister's article in the Belfast Telegraph and the foreign secretary's statement to the House of Commons. As part of that, she said, before any changes are made, we will consult with businesses and people in Northern Ireland as our proposals are put forward. The legislative route is something that we are doing as part of a dual-track approach, but our strong preference is absolutely to reach agreed changes with the European Union.
UK Ambassador to Ireland Paul Johnston talking to Brian Dobson on the News at 1. And it was week three of the inflation shopping basket with Adam Maguire. And this time it was a look at the price of your coffee and bickies.
But today you have decided that you're going to look at coffee and biscuits.
Yeah, a nice little combination. So we have our little box of biscuits here.
Yeah.
And we have our coffee beans. We've got some chocolate chip. We've got a mixture in there of chocolate chip biscuits. We've got some coffee beans as well. So a nice combo, nothing better than sitting down, cup of coffee, nice biscuit as a little treat. If you're a tea drinker, don't worry, because what we're talking about with coffee kind of impacts tea too. So the price is affected there as well.
We're going to start with the biscuits.
Yeah, biscuits. A really, really interesting one, because you think of them as a fairly basic product. They're actually a really good representation though of how incredibly complex the global supply chain is, something that we'd all take for granted and maybe have up until recently. So to show you what I mean, I said we have chocolate chip cookies in here, or biscuits. Even with recent price rises, you'd probably buy a pack of them for about €1, a cheap packet for about €1. But if you were to make them yourself, you're looking at maybe 7 or 8 ingredients. So again, seems fairly simple. But when you break it down, it's actually incredibly complex. So you have flour, obviously. In Ireland, most of our flour comes from the UK. But a lot of that, in turn, is coming from Canada or the Ukraine. Then you have sugar, which is probably coming from Brazil or India, but it might be getting refined in Romania or Portugal. eggs and butter, that could be something that you're coming, it's coming from an Irish producer. But if you're a big manufacturer, if you're a big bakery, you might be sourcing it from the Netherlands or from Poland or Turkey or even New Zealand, which is a major exporter of butter. The chocolate may be coming from Belgium or Germany, but the cocoa beans to make that chocolate is coming from the Ivory Coast or Ghana. The vanilla in the vanilla extract is coming from Madagascar or Indonesia. The salt might be coming from China. The bicarbonate of soda might be coming from China, the US. So all these ingredients coming from all around the world through, you know, UK or EU based companies. And what's amazing about it is that usually they end up on our shelves, they're readily available, quite cheap, and they allow you to make your own biscuits or buy them for very little amounts of money.
Well, that's an astonishing feat in itself that that would be the case, you know, given that they come from all of those different places.
Yeah.
So now that we have Brexit, a war in Europe, we're post-pandemic, just about. What's gone wrong?
Yeah, well, a lot. The supply chain has taken a couple of knocks, and you've mentioned some of the reasons behind it. So Brexit is the first one, especially in Ireland. Because if you think about the big biscuit brands on supermarket shelves and confectionery in general, the chances are, with a couple of exceptions, they're British-based. And even some of the big European brands would probably have supplied the Irish market with bars and biscuits that were made in UK factories. And when you look at, say, the retailers' own brand stuff, which there'd be a lot of that on shelves as well, a lot of that was made under contract by British producers. And before Brexit, that was fine because it just came over the Irish Sea, no checks, no issue whatsoever. But once the UK left the EU, it became far more complicated than that.
So how are those products treated now?
Yeah, well, without wanting to drill down too far into the nitty-gritty of it all, under the Brexit deal, as people might remember, that came into force at the start of last year, if you've a British-made product and you export to the EU, you don't pay a tariff. So that's fine. Same goes in the other direction as well. But if you are, say, a UK company and you import something from a third country and then export it to the EU, you pay a tariff on that. So these are what's called rules of origin. So it defines, depending on where it starts and where it ends, you might have to pay a tariff. But then there's a middle ground, and this is where we start to get a bit messy. So if you import a product from a third country, say like flour, and then you do something with it to change it, so maybe mix it with lots of other ingredients to make a brand new product, you might be able to get away with avoiding the tariff. You might be able to say it is now a British or European product. But it's not straightforward at all. You basically have to get into the weeds on the rules and regulations around weight restrictions, value limits on how much you're coming from a third country, how much production was done to actually justify it being a new product rather than just the same old product. And you really have to know your way around the fine print of the EU-UK trade and cooperation agreement to know exactly how that applies. I mean, I was talking to one tax expert who said they think there would be a 9% tariff applied if you couldn't show that you met all these rules and regulations, but they couldn't be sure because it's just so
complex.
And this is an expert. It's just so complex. And the problem is, even if you can bypass that tariff, you have to show then that why that's the case. So you need all this paperwork, which then has to be checked, which means you're slowing down the supply chain, you're adding complexity. So even if nothing else changes, it becomes that little bit harder, a little bit more expensive to bring a biscuit or the ingredients of a biscuit from the UK over to Ireland.
Adam Maguire, RTE business journalist, from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.